Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter at News Talk Science. Now, coming up on this week's programme, it's a strange study special. Sound effect. To start us off, what can we learn from whale earwax and why are we even asking that question?
Earwax. It can tell you certain things about a person, like how much you prioritise personal hygiene, for example. It can't tell you how stressed you were feeling in 1996, though, unless that is you happen to be a whale. Stephen J. Trumbull from the Department of Biology at Baylor University joins me now to tell me more. Welcome to the programme, Stephen. Tell me, why do you work with whale wax?
Well, I mean, the short answer is that they've been aging whales for over a century using whale earwax, earwax plugs. And it just so happens that myself and my colleague, Sasha Yusenko, came up with this idea a number of years ago that if we look at the individual bands that they use for aging, if we can get some sort of a chemical signature from these bands, that we should be able to kind of reconstruct their chemical profile through their life. So short answer, sort of.
That is really disgusting. Can I ask, did you say plugs? Do you actually mean like a plug of gunk that comes out of the ear in a solid ball?
Yeah, it looks more like it's kind of like like a candle. It's typically they're 10, 15, 20 centimeters long. But the longest one we've ever received was 53 centimeters long and weighed about 800 and some odd grams.
2 feet long, almost.
Yeah. So they're a good, that's from a bowhead whale. It's not quite a ball, but it's, kind of long and tapered at the end. It's got some nice smell to it, as you might guess.
So I have so many questions. The first question is, why work with whale wax? You're saying that you can age whales by earwax. Do you mean like counting the rings of a tree or something?
Absolutely. That's exactly what the old whalers figured this out decades ago. Literally counting the rings and dividing by two, and you get a really nice approximation for age. And my colleague who did work with sediment cores, he was like, oh, sort of like a sediment core in the animal. And then we kind of came up with the idea that there's probably chemicals within those individual rings or lines, and sure enough, it worked. And so we were able to kind of move on from there.
Well, I want to get into that in a bit, but first, how do you get hold of the earwax of a whale? I'm imagining a sort of a Moby Dick scenario with a Q-tip.
Yeah, not quite. Most of the whale plugs that we get are from museums, and museums have been collecting whale earplugs for since 1909, believe it or not.
What?
Who is doing that
and why?
Well, I mean, you have to understand that museums collect everything, right? And this was during the whaling era. They would collect various tissues, ovaries, eyeballs, the earplugs, because they use them for aging. They just stuck them in a jar, and the museums took them, and they've archived them, and they've kept them for all these years. And the science has finally caught up with this whale earplug research, and
Someone finally found something to do with the dozens of jars of ancient whale earwax.
Yeah. To give you some idea of how many, we were just in a museum in Canada and they have about 4,000 earplugs.
Oh my God. So how does the earwax form? Is it do whales' ears function exactly the way humans do? I mean, I know they're mammals, but is it a similar process?
No, that's a really good question. So the baleen whales are the only whales that we know of that have earplugs. And yes, they generate earwax much like we do. They have a tympanic membrane. It's a little bit different structure as far as that, because they listen at a different frequency than we do. So their kind of anatomy is a little different. But they produce earwax just like we do. The difference is that, you know, our earwax is exposed to the external environment, whereas theirs is basically trapped inside their head. And the only way you can get to it is from a dead whale. When an animal washes up on the beach dead or is floating out there dead, I mean, this is the only way you can get to it. You cannot get to it from the outside of the animal like you can humans.
So this is sebum, is that right? It's collected sebum from the sebaceous gland. It's the stuff that makes our hair greasy and gives people pimples, right?
Right. It's keratin, lipids, and wax kind of mixed together, just like our earwax. I mean, human earwax is, you know, it's, you know, there's, depending on your genetics, some's really dry, some's really liquidy and soft, just depends. But yeah, similar.
And so does it vary amongst whales, or does all earwax, once you know one, once you've met one whale's earwax, you've met them all?
No, very different. The bowhead whale was very kind of liquidy and almost gelatinous. And some of the other species are smaller and very kind of dense. Some are long and skinny. Some are short and stout. It's just species different.
You know, I've never said this on this program, but I actually feel properly nauseous talking about this. And I've talked about almost everything. This is really grossing me out. So you've got this earwax, and you study, you know, how old the whales are from studying these ancient plugs. What else can you learn from poking around in the dirt?
Well, I mean, as far as the earwax is concerned, I mean, the interesting part is, and you've kind of touched on this, is we have an age component to the animal. So if we know the animal, for say, let's say, died in 1970, and then we just back calculate, because we know the age from the plug, that we can go back to, you know, 1930. And so now we have a record of chemicals from the, you know, 1940s and 50s and 60s, and what chemicals have been taken up by the animal, what's been produced by the animal, and like how many pregnancies, how many
almost. Wow. So you're seeing hormones then preserved in the wax?
Seeing hormones, we're looking at pregnancy hormones, stress hormones. We're actually getting DNA from these layers now. So we're looking at DNA methylation and how that pertains to stress. We know, you know, yeah, we can look at it in relation to sea surface temperature and shipping noise and see how these animals are influenced and how they respond to their environment. We see pregnancy rates. We see all sorts of neat things. What contaminants are coming on board and what are going off of the animal through like lactation and things like that. So the amount of information we're getting from these earplugs is absolutely astounding.
It sounds like you can sort of press rewind on these whales to sort of understand in pretty good detail the things that happened to them. Why is that important to learn about?
Well, it's important because if we know what the animal and hence the population is experiencing, and if we can kind of correlate that or associate that with various, you know, environmental stressors like the war, like whaling, like sea surface temperature change. And then we get an idea of like how to better manage the population moving forward.
So you said the war. Do you really think you could see stress patterns dated to a particular year during which there was a conflict, and that would turn up in the wax of a whale's ear?
Yeah, we actually saw that. We just published that in our latest paper. So during the 39 to 45, we see an increase in stress in the animals we were looking at and a decrease in the whaling effort. So we probably attribute that to whatever war activity is going on, especially noise. You know, so much more noise in the ocean, ships and, you know, submarines, torpedoes, planes, you name it. So, yeah, these animals definitely were stressed out during that period of time relative to what we saw prior to that period.
Wow, that is so interesting. I was just thinking that you reminded me of the hormone changes that happen during adolescence and mating time. Are they the sort of things that you can also see in the wax data?
Exactly. Yeah, we do see that. And because we have a lifetime profile of an animal, and we can baseline correct for the individual, we can see if it's had elevations in, testosterone, and this is how we can determine pregnancies or potential pregnancies. So we can see that.
So you'd be able to tell from earwax of a 100-year-old whale how many babies it had.
Yes, and actually for the study, we're just about ready to publish another study that actually we look at three or four different species of whales, and we get pregnancy rates, and we're finding all sorts of new information about these species.
Which is quite exciting, right? Because a lot of whales you don't know much about because of the nature of their migration pattern. A lot of whales just disappear for a very long time, and we don't know a huge amount about them. To get information from their earwax as to how many babies they have, and potentially what waters they were in, because I presume there's some sort of way you can trace geography, can we, in terms of the chemicals found in their earwax that relates to geographical location?
Absolutely. You're right. We can determine pregnancy rates, which as you kind of pointed out, you can't really do unless you're, traipsing about on a ship in the ocean following whales for their whole life, which is you can't do because it costs too much money, and who's got that kind of time? So, and yes, using stable isotope signatures, we can see sort of where they've gone, what sort of a trophic regime they're kind of playing around in at the time. And we know that most of the plugs that we've been working at this far are northern hemisphere. And so we have a fairly good idea of like where they've been, especially from the whaling era, where they've been captured or hunted. So we have a fairly good idea of what's going on there. And using kind of going backwards from that, and using the stable isotopes, and sort of figure out where they've gone and where they've come from.
That's like you get so much information from some guck in an animal's ear. What about other animals? Can you do the same for coyotes or, I don't know, I mean, like what sort of information could you get? Could you analyze my earwax and see how many babies I've fathered?
No.
The answer, if my wife is listening, is just two.
Yeah, that's right. we could, for a price, we could validate that for you. No, you couldn't do that because we don't really lay down wax continuously through our life and form a plug.
Not typically. Right.
And plus, like I said, it's exposed to the external environment. So whatever's in the external environment can also get in your plug, your earwax, as far as a human. But
are there other animals, though?
Oh, yeah.
You think of whales, obviously whales are ideal because it's internal their whole life. Are there other animals that have that ear canal closed off that you can get lifetime longitudinal data from?
We don't think so. We've heard some kind of anecdotal evidence about like sperm whales. We haven't got any plugs yet. There's research that have been done on like whiskers and some baleen from whales.
What's a baleen?
Baleen is the filter feeding mechanism, and we've been able to isolate chemicals from that. Now, you're not going to get the lifetime signature. It's more of a kind of a few years at the most, but it's still pretty nice and worthwhile to play around with. There are people doing research on claws of various animals because they kind of grow continuously through life. And there's, like I said, whiskers, and there's some hair studies out there on like metals and things like that. But as far as lifetime work, there's really nothing that really compares with the earplug.
I spoke last year to a woman who was collecting whale snot, and it seems that that there are lots of people doing pretty disgusting work on the orifices of whales. And I wonder if you guys have a social network or something like a Facebook group.
We should.
You
we
should. Don't. I think you should. Yeah. I think you should. I've probably taken this as far as I wanted to take it, to be honest. Probably a little bit further. Well, one question, I'll close my ears, but people might be interested before we go. I wasn't going to ask it at the time because I really don't want to hear this. So I'll ask you the question and you can answer, but I'm not going to hear the. I'm just going to say thank you very much. So the question is, what does the earwax smell like?
So earplugs are, like I said, like a candle, a fairly kind of malleable and soft, and they're very fishy smelling, as you can imagine, and very, very pungent. And so this is what grad students are good for. They get to play around with the earplugs and have all that smell to play around with, where I get to sit in my office and write the papers.
Okay, I'm getting a signal from my producer, so I'm going to take my fingers out of my ears now and say thank you, Stephen J. Trumbull, PhD, Associate Professor at the Department of Biology at Baylor University. Enjoy the rest of your life.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Thanks, Stephen. That was great. Take care, man.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Right.
Well, to be quite frank, I'm quite glad that's over. Now, after a decade of this program, we've learned many things. And one of the principal lessons I've learned is that scientists are both dedicated and innovative a lot of the time. Some will experiment on themselves. Some will literally go to the ends of the earth to prove what they believe to be true. And some, like my next guest, will play hide and seek with rats. Why? Well, let's find out. Dr. Michael Brecht is a professor of systems neurobiology and neural computation at the Bernstein Center for Computational Neuroscience at Humboldt University, Berlin. God, it seems like these titles are getting longer and longer. Michael, welcome to the program.
They sure do.
How are you?
Very good, very good.
So, what can we learn really from playing hide and seek with rats? Why is play of any interest to a neuroscientist?
Oh, okay, I think play is one of the less well understood behaviors. And it's often been a bit dismissed as childish or sort of not so important. But we think it's not true. A lot of the play behaviors that we studied over the years, they turn out to be very complicated. And we'll talk in more depth about this in hide and seek. We think often both animals and humans, they are at their best when they play. Yeah, sort of it's really something, a very special behavior that engages the brain very heavily and it's quite unique.
Okay, so I have lots of questions about this. Perhaps can you paint a picture with words to describe exactly how you ran this experiment to teach rats from a lab how to play hide and seek?
So what we found is that they learn it very well. The first thing you have to make sure is that they feel very comfortable. So it takes a while for them to accommodate to the big room. So these are lab rats that we work with, and we played it in a big room. And it took quite a bit of time until they're very comfortable there. Once they're comfortable there, they learn it pretty fast. We do it stepwise, sort of, for example, when you teach them to hide, you first reinforce them a little bit for going away from you. Then you, and the reinforcement we choose is not food. We didn't want to condition them. We just wanted to have it playful. So what we did as a reward is we play a little bit with them. We tickle them a little bit. And what you
I'm
do
sorry, what?
Is we tickle them a little bit. They love to be tickled. Yeah. So rats are very ticklish and they are thrilled to be tickled. Yeah. So, and what you do is first you do this when they go a little bit away, then you do play with them only when they sort of went far away. And finally you do it only when they properly hide. And the same with seek. First you reward them for coming to you and you go only a small distance away and then you start really hiding and the animals, they get it very fast and they get very good at it and they're very strategic about it. We'll talk about this, I think.
So I'm just wondering why you would choose tickling as a reward as opposed to food or a sugar drip, which is often used for rewarding labs. Why not give them the traditional reward that you'd give in these sort of experiments.
Yeah, I understand. So what we wanted to do, it's been shown a long time ago by Skinner, 100 years ago, that you can condition the animals with rewards to do very complicated behaviors. Yeah, you can sort of train an animal to do something. We wanted, the design of our study was more that we go for real playful interactions. And we didn't want to have this heavy reward, but just a small one. And it was meant to be positive. So when if we would be non-reactive when they find us, so I think they wouldn't get a thrill out of it. So what happens in these experiments is that you have a pretty close relationship with the animal, and when they find you, you are playful with them, and this is something that works very well.
So this is a 300 square foot room fitted with boxes and barriers where you or the rats can hide from each other. And yeah. Over the course of 2 weeks, you manage to get them comfortable in the room and then not condition them, but encourage them to be comfortable enough to play hide and seek. And you say when they went hunting for you and found you, they were thrilled. Now, that doesn't sound like a very scientific term. What do you mean by thrilled?
Yeah, okay. Let's maybe first talk a little bit how they search for us and why we think that they do the game properly. And then we have also strong idea that they do it for the fun of it. But let me first explain the game a little bit.
Yeah.
So why do we think they really play the game? Sort of when they search, they are very strategic about it. So they would very systematically search the room. They would usually go to new hiding places. What they would also do, they would memorize where we did hide before. So if you hide a bunch of the times in the same place, they find you in no time.
My five-year-old has not figured that out yet.
Yeah, and same with hiding. They're also very strategic about that. So when they hide, they typically switch hiding locations. They are very silent when they hide. Normally during the game, they vocalize a lot. It's all ultrasound, so normally you can't hear that, but we had ultrasound microphones all over the place so that we could hear it. And normally they are very vocal, but when they go hiding, they shut up. Yeah. Then what we did is we offered them kind of silly hiding places. Namely, we offered them either transparent boxes in which we could see them, or dark boxes, which were good hiding places. And when they play hide, and actually only then, they have a very strong preference for these dark, non-transparent boxes. So they are very strategic about the hiding and the seeking.
Wait. You're saying that they knew not to hide in a transparent box because they knew that you'd see them.
That's what we think. We think this is the best explanation because
the way you test that to me in my mind is you would then, once you've played in that room for a while, introduce a new but different shaped transparent box in a different location and see if they ever hid there. Wouldn't that be?
We changed the hiding places regularly. It was not always the same.
So they figured out the nature of transparency and that transparency
what we think is that they probably have some kind of this might I don't think they learned that in that week when we played with them. I think they have some kind of hiding routine that they pull down, and if they're in the hiding mode, it's a bad idea to go in a transparent thing.
Wow.
I think it's probably something they use also otherwise, right? They're a prey animal, a small animal, so they often need to take very good care not to be found. So they probably have routines for that. Yeah.
And when they were looking for you, what sort of behaviors did they show? Did they make any mistakes, or did they make any assumptions that humans wouldn't have?
Yeah. Two things. First of all, when they play the game, over the time, you get very much the feeling that they play a role. Yeah, like when they hide and we find them, they react totally different from when they find us when we hide. Sort of when we find them and they hide, they actually say they don't vocalize at all. They're very silent and they look a bit pissed off, yeah. and then they find you, the behavior is totally the opposite. So they as soon as they see you, they vocalize, yeah, and they come running and shoot at you. You get the feeling that they behave in, that they play a role, a hiding role or a seeker, a hunter role, yeah? Now, do they do mistakes? At least initially, we had the impression that when they learn the game, that they don't have a very good understanding of how big we are. Yeah. So what they would do is they are very professional about the seeking. As I told you, they seek very systematically. But what they would do, they would look in very little boxes and little niches. and I could have told you them, okay, Annika, the experimenter, she's not going to be hiding in there. She's much too large for that box. But that's something where we had the impression they don't have that straight. They don't really know how big we are. Yeah,
and that's this. There's this idea, isn't there, in psychology of theory of mind? The idea that someone can imagine what the other person is see something from the other person's perspective. And I suppose in that case, they didn't, but they also did seem to show some idea of what you might be thinking.
Yes, we wonder if they have theory of mind. We don't think that our experiments prove this. Yeah, let's be straight about this. We typically, it's something that people investigated in monkeys or little children, and there it's pretty clear. And it takes many years for a child to develop a theory of mind. Yeah, a little, a very young child can't do that. With the rats, some of the behaviors look like they might be able to do that perspective taking. For example, this hiding in the non-transparent box, that's kind of factoring in our seeking behavior. Huh. Also, occasionally you see things that look like that are very suggestive. For example, the seeker, the human seeker, would bypass their hiding place, miss them, and they would behind the back shoot into another place where the seeker already looked after them.
Wow. Yeah?
So it's a sort of very clever, it's suggestive to me that they think, oh, he checked out there, that they factor that into their behavior. But I think this needs more work to prove this. So this is something actually a future directive that we have. We want to use this hide-and-seek paradigm to check for theory of mind in rodents. Yeah.
Are you looking at what's going on under the skin in terms of what neurons are firing, the neuroscience of decision-making, or what sort of things are happening inside the brain as they play this game of hide and seek in a 300-foot square room?
Yes, yeah, we did that. So we looked in the prefrontal cortex. It's a very high-level controlled structure. And we looked what is happening in their brains during the game. And what we found, first of all, is that play very strongly engages these high-level centers. But we also saw quite a bit of activity where we wonder if it could potentially instruct role play. Sort of, for example, a lot of the cells were responsive to the cue we give the animals to tell them if they have to seek or if they have to hide. So the way we tell the animal that it has to seek us is we put it in the start box and we close that box. Yeah.
Right.
And then we hide and remotely open it and they have to look for us. In the other trials, when they have to hide, we leave the start box open and we sort of sit immobile there and they have to run away. So what we found, if we looked into the brain, a lot of the cells were very strongly responsive to us closing that box. Yeah, the cue that tells them, oh, you're it, or you're the seeker.
Yeah. Yeah?
So we therefore think that these parts of the brain are probably involved in instructing role play, in telling the animal to behave as if it's afraid of us or as if it's running after us. Yeah.
when the rats found you, they did what's described in German as a Freudensprung. What is that? Can you describe that behavior?
Oh, okay. This is a very old and classic mammalian behavior. Sort of a lot of mammals do that when they're thrilled. Like, for example, when they find us or when we tickle them, they would often do these joy jumps, little jumps. And this is
a joy a joy jump, you said.
Yeah, yeah. It's they jump. Yeah, a little bit more like a kangaroo. It's not the usual jump you see in the cage, and many mammals do that. Like, we have rabbits at home, and the first time they go out in the spring in the garden, they would run around and then just take off. They jump, yeah. Or little lambs also do that, and where you also always see that in soccer, in football, yeah. The guy, he scores a goal, then he runs a little bit, and then he jumps. Yeah.
I was thinking of handball and netball teams.
Yeah,
and so, volleyball teams do this quite a lot.
Also, humans do that. Yeah, wow. Sort of. If you do something very good, you score a goal, you run a little bit, and then you jump.
God, that's I didn't know that was a thing for not just humans. That's weird to think that rats do that.
No, all enthusiastic mammals. And the weird thing is, all mammals that are very thrilled, also cows. You know, the cows have been in the winter in the sort of are not allowed to go out. The first time they go out, you'll see the cows jump, much like it looks so weird because a cow is really a not very jumpy animal. But it's something that mammals do when they are very thrilled.
Cows do joy jumps when they get out of the barn for the first time.
Yes.
Okay, this is something I need. Like, this is the most adorable science I have ever heard. But can it teach us anything of use? I mean, not that I think that is important, particularly. I think the great thing about science is it is learning to know more. But is this research on play useful for humans, do you think?
Absolutely. I think our brains are built such that we play, and these playful capacities of our brains, I think they are most underrated. Yeah, I think it's not coincidental that some of the behaviors that we saw in the hide and seek playing rats, they're really cognitively some of the most complicated behaviors we ever seen in rats. And I think it's a total mistake to dismiss play as something simple and childish. I think it's something where the brain is often at its peak. So I think we need more appreciation for the playful capacities of us.
I have to say, this is probably my favorite interview of the year. Professor Michael Brecht from Humboldt University in Berlin. Thank you so much. Really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.